He had student conferences every day, and he attended faithfully all departmental meetings. He did not speak often at these meetings, but when he did, he spoke without tact or diplomacy, so that among his colleagues he developed a reputation for crustiness and ill temper. But with his young students he was gentle and patient, though he demanded of them more work than they were willing to give, with an impersonal firmness that was hard for many of them to understand. It was a commonplace among his colleagues, especially the younger ones, that he was a dedicated teacher, a term they used half in envy and half in contempt, one whose dedication blinded him to anything that went on outside the classroom, or at the most outside the halls of the university. There were mild jokes. After a departmental meeting at which Stoner had spoken bluntly about some recent experiments in the teaching of grammar, a young instructor remarked that, to Stoner, copulation is restricted to verbs, and was surprised at the quality of laughter and meaningful looks exchanged by some of the older men. Someone else once said, "Old Stoner thinks that WPA stands for wrong pronoun antecedent," and was gratified to learn that his witticism gained some currency. But William Stoner knew of the world in a way that few of his younger colleagues could understand. Deep in him, beneath his memory, was the knowledge of hardship and hunger and endurance and pain. Though he seldom thought of his early years on the Boonville farm, there was always near his consciousness the blood knowledge of his inheritance, given him by forefathers whose lives were obscure and hard and stoical, and whose common ethic was to present to an oppressive world faces that were expressionless and hard and bleak. And though he looked upon them with apparent impassivity, he was aware of the times in which he lived. During that decade when many men's faces found a permanent hardness and bleakness, as if they looked upon an abyss, William Stoner, to whom that expression was as familiar as the air he walked in, saw the signs of a general despair he had known since he was a boy. He saw good men go down into a slow decline of hopelessness, broken as their vision of a decent life was broken. He saw them walking aimlessly upon the streets, their eyes empty like shards of broken glass. He saw them walk up to back doors with the bitter pride of men who go to their executions, and beg for the bread that would allow them to beg again. And he saw men who had once walked erect in their own identities look at him with envy and hatred for the poor security he enjoyed as a tenured employee of an institution that somehow could not fail. He did not give voice to this awareness, but the knowledge of common misery touched him and changed him in ways that were hidden deep from the public view, and a quiet sadness for the common plight was never far beneath any moment of his living. He was aware, too, of the stirrings in Europe, like a distant nightmare. And in July 1936, when Franco rebelled against the Spanish government and Hitler fanned that rebellion into a major war, Stoner, like many others, was sickened by the vision of the nightmare breaking out of the dream into the world. When the fall semester began that year, the younger instructors could talk of little else. Several of them proclaimed their intention of joining a volunteer unit and fighting for the Loyalists or driving ambulances. By the close of the first semester, a few of them had actually taken the step and submitted hasty resignations. Stoner thought of Dave Masters, and the old loss was brought back to him with a renewed intensity. He thought, too, of Archer Sloane, and remembered from nearly 20 years before the slow anguish that had grown upon that ironic face and the erosive despair that had dissipated that hard self. And he thought that he knew now, in a small way, something of the sense of waste that Sloane had apprehended. He foresaw the years that stretched ahead, and knew that the worst was to come. As Archer Sloane had done, he realized the futility and waste of committing oneself wholly to the irrational and dark forces that impelled the world toward its unknown end. as Archer Sloane had not done, Stoner withdrew a little distance to pity and love, so that he was not caught in the rushing that he observed. And as in other moments of crisis and despair, he looked again to the cautious faith that was embodied in the institution of the university. He told himself that it was not much, but he knew that it was all he had. In the summer of 1937, he felt a renewal of the old passion for study and learning, and with the curious and disembodied vigor of the scholar, that is the condition of neither youth nor age, he returned to the only life that had not betrayed him. He discovered that he had not gone far from that life, even in his despair. His schedule that fall was particularly bad. His four classes of freshman composition were spaced at widely separated hours, 6 days a week. During all his years as chairman, Lomax had not once failed to give Stoner a teaching schedule that even the newest instructor would have accepted with bad grace. On the first class day of that academic year, in the early morning, Stoner sat in his office and looked again at his neatly typed schedule. He had been up late the night before reading a new study of the survival of the medieval tradition into the Renaissance, and the excitement he had felt carried over to the morning. He looked at his schedule, and a dull anger rose within him. He stared at the wall in front of him for several moments, glanced at his schedule again, and nodded to himself. He dropped the schedule and the attached syllabus into a wastebasket and went to his filing cabinet in a corner of the room. He pulled out the top drawer, looked absently at the brown folders there, and withdrew one. He flipped through the papers in the folder, whistling silently as he did so. Then he closed the drawer, and with the folder under one arm, went out of his office and across the campus to his first class. The building was an old one with wooden floors, and it was used as a classroom only in emergencies. The room to which he had been assigned was too small for the number of students enrolled, so that several of the boys had to sit on the window sills or stand. When Stoner came in, they looked at him with the discomfort of uncertainty. He might be friend or foe, and they did not know which was worse. He apologized to the students for the room, made a small joke at the expense of the registrar, and assured those who were standing that there would be chairs for them tomorrow. Then he put his folder on the battered lectern that rested unevenly on the desk, and surveyed the faces before him. He hesitated for a moment. Then he said, "Those of you who have purchased your texts for this course may return them to the bookstore and get a refund. We shall not be using the texts described in the syllabus, which I take it you all received when you signed up for the course. Neither will we be using the syllabus. I intend in this course to take a different approach to the subject, an approach which will necessitate your buying two new texts." He turned his back to the students and picked up a piece of chalk from the trough beneath the scuffed blackboard. He held the chalk poised for a moment and listened to the muted sigh and rustle of the students as they settled at their desks, enduring the routine that suddenly became familiar to them. Stoner said, "Our texts will be," and he enunciated the words slowly as he wrote them down, "Medieval English, verse and prose, edited by Loomis and Willard, and English Literary Criticism, The Medieval Phase, by J. W. H. Atkins." He turned to the class. "You will find that the bookstore has not yet received these books. It may be as much as 2 weeks before they are in. In the meantime, I will give you some background information upon the matter and purpose of this course, and I shall make a few library assignments to keep you occupied." He paused. Many of the students were bent over their desks, assiduously noting what he said. A few were looking at him steadily with small smiles that wanted to be intelligent and understanding, and a few were staring at him in open amazement. "The primary matter of this course," Stoner said, "will be found in the Loomis and Willard anthology. We shall study examples of medieval verse and prose for three purposes. First, as literary works, significant in themselves. Second, as a demonstration of the beginnings of literary style and method in the English tradition. And third, as rhetorical and grammatical solutions to problems of discourse that even today may be of some practical value and application. By this time nearly all the students had stopped taking notes and had raised their heads. Even the intelligent smiles had become a trifle strained, and a few hands were waving in the air. Stoner pointed to one whose hand remained steady and high, a tall young man with dark hair and glasses.
"Sir, is this General English 1, Section 4?"
Stoner smiled at the young man.
"What is your name, please?"
The boy swallowed.
"Jessup, sir. Frank Jessup."
Stoner nodded.
"Mr. Jessup. Yes, Mr. Jessup, this is General English 1, Section 4. And my name is Stoner. Facts which no doubt I should have mentioned at the beginning of the period. Did you have another question?"
The boy swallowed again.
"No, sir."
Stoner nodded and looked benevolently around the room.
"Does anyone else have a question?"
The faces stared back at him. There were no smiles, and a few mouths hung open.
"Very well," Stoner said. "I shall continue. As I said at the beginning of this hour, one purpose of this course is to study certain works of the period, roughly between 1200 and 1500. Certain accidents of history will stand in our way. There will be linguistic difficulties as well as philosophical, social as well as religious, theoretical as well as practical. Indeed, all of our past education will in some ways hinder us, for our habits of thinking about the nature of experience have determined our own expectations as radically as the habits of medieval man determined his. As a preliminary, let us examine some of those habits of mind under which medieval man lived and thought and wrote." That first meeting he did not keep the students for the entire hour. After less than half the period, he brought his preliminary discussion to a close and gave them a weekend assignment.
"I should like for each of you to write a brief essay, no more than 3 pages, upon Aristotle's conception of the topoi, or in its rather crude English translation, topic. You will find an extended discussion of the topic in Book 2 of the Rhetoric of Aristotle, and in Lane Cooper's edition there is an introductory essay that you will find most helpful. The essay will be due on Monday. And that, I think, will be all for today."
For a moment after he dismissed the class, he gazed at the students, who did not move, with some concern. Then he nodded briefly to them and walked out of the classroom, the brown folder under his arm. On Monday, fewer than half the students had finished their papers. He dismissed those who handed their essays in, and spent the rest of the hour with the remaining students, rehearsing the subject he had assigned, going over it again and again, until he was sure they had it and could complete the assigned essay by Wednesday. On Tuesday, he noticed in the corridors of Jesse Hall, outside Lomax's office, a group of students. He recognized them as members of his first class. As he passed, the students turned away from him and looked at the floor or the ceiling, or at the door of Lomax's office. He smiled to himself and went to his office, and waited for the telephone call that he knew would come. It came at 2 o'clock that afternoon. He picked up the phone, answered, and heard the voice of Lomax's secretary, icy and polite.
"Professor Stoner, Professor Lomax would like you to see Professor Earhart this afternoon as soon as possible. Professor Earhart will be expecting you."
"Will Lomax be there?" Stoner asked. There was a shocked pause. The voice said uncertainly,
"I believe not. A previous appointment. But Professor Earhart is empowered to—"
"You tell Lomax he ought to be there. You tell him I'll be in Earhart's office in 10 minutes. Joel Earhart was a balding young man in his early 30s. He had been brought into the department 3 years before by Lomax, and when it was discovered that he was a pleasant and serious young man with no special talent and no gift for teaching, he had been put in charge of the freshman English program. His office was in a small enclosure at the far end of the large common room, where 20-odd young instructors had their desks, and Stoner had to walk the length of the room to get there. As he made his way among the desks, some of the instructors looked up at him, grinned openly, and watched his progress across the room. Stoner opened the door without knocking, went into the office, and sat down in the chair opposite Earhart's desk. Lomax was not there. "You wanted to see me?" Stoner asked. Earhart, who had a very fair skin, blushed slightly. He fixed a smile on his face, said enthusiastically, "It's good of you to drop by, Bill," and fumbled for a moment with a match, trying to light his pipe. It wouldn't draw properly. "This damned humidity," he said morosely. "It keeps the tobacco too wet." "Lomax won't be here, I take it," Stoner said. "No," Earhart said, putting the pipe on his desk. "Actually, though, it was Professor Lomax who asked me to talk to you. So, in a way," he laughed nervously, "I'm really sort of a messenger boy."
"What message were you asked to deliver?" Stoner asked dryly.
"Well, as I understand it, there have been a few complaints. Students, you know." He shook his head commiseratingly. "Some of them seem to think, well, they don't really seem to understand what's going on in your 8 o'clock class. Professor Lomax thought, well, actually, I suppose he's questioning the wisdom of approaching the problems of freshman composition through the study of
medieval language and literature," Stoner said.
"Yes," Earhart said. "Actually, I think I understand what you're trying to do. Shock them a bit. Shake them up. Try a new approach. Get them to thinking, right?"
Stoner nodded gravely. "There's been a great deal of talk in our freshman comp meetings lately about new methods, experimentation."
"Exactly," Earhart said. "No one has more sympathy than I for experimentation, but perhaps sometimes, out of the very best motives, we go too far."
He laughed and shook his head.
"I certainly know I do. I'd be the first to confess it. But I, or Professor Lomax, well, perhaps some sort of compromise, some partial return to the syllabus, a use of the assigned texts, you understand."
Stoner pursed his lips and looked at the ceiling. Resting his elbows on the arms of the chair, he placed the tips of his fingers together and let his chin rest on his thumb tips. Finally, but decisively, he said, "No, I don't believe the experiment has had a fair chance. Tell Lomax I intend to carry it through to the end of the semester. Would you do that for me?"
Earhart's face was red. He said tightly, "I will. But I imagine, I'm sure, Professor Lomax will be most disappointed. Most disappointed indeed."
Stoner said, "Oh, at first he may be, but he'll get over it. I'm sure Professor Lomax wouldn't want to interfere with the way a senior professor sees fit to teach one of his classes. He may disagree with the judgment of that professor, but it would be most unethical for him to attempt to impose his own judgment, and, incidentally, a little dangerous. Don't you agree?"
Earhart picked up his pipe, gripped its bowl tightly, and contemplated it fiercely. "I'll tell Professor Lomax of your decision."
"I'd be grateful if you would," Stoner said. He rose from his chair, walked to the door, paused as if reminded of something, and turned to Earhart. He said casually, "Oh, another thing. I've been doing a little thinking about next semester. If my experiment works out, next semester I might try something else. I've been considering the possibility of getting at some of the problems of composition by examining the survival of the classical and medieval Latin tradition in some of Shakespeare's plays,
It may sound a little specialized, but I think I can bring it down to a workable level. You might pass my little idea along to Lomax. Ask him to turn it over in his mind. Maybe in a few weeks you and I can—" Earhart slumped in his chair. He dropped his pipe on the table and said wearily, "All right, Bill, I'll tell him. Thanks for dropping by." Stoner nodded. He opened the door, went out, closed it carefully behind him, and walked across the long room. When one of the young instructors looked up at him inquiringly, he winked broadly, nodded, and, finally, let the smile come over his face. He went to his office, sat at his desk, and waited, looking out the open doorway. After a few minutes he heard a door slam down the hall, heard the uneven sound of footsteps, and saw Lomax go past his office as swiftly as his limp would carry him. Stoner did not move from his watch. Within half an hour he heard Lomax's slow, shuffling ascent of the stairway, and saw him go once more past his office. He waited until he heard the door down the hall close, then he nodded to himself, got up, and went home. It was some weeks later that Stoner learned from Finch himself what happened that afternoon when Lomax stormed into his office. Lomax complained bitterly about Stoner's behavior, described how he was teaching what amounted to his senior course in Middle English to his freshman class, and demanded that Finch take disciplinary measures. There was a moment of silence. Finch started to say something, and then he burst out laughing. He laughed for a long time, every now and then trying to say something that was pushed back by laughter. Finally he quieted, apologized to Lomax for his outburst, and said, "He's got you, Holly. Don't you see that? He's not about to let go, and there's not a damn thing you can do. You want me to do the job for you? How do you think that would look? A dean meddling in how a senior member of the department teaches his classes, and meddling at the instigation of the department chairman himself. No, sir. You take care of it yourself the best way you can. But you really don't have much choice, do you?" 2 weeks after that conversation, Stoner received a memo from Lomax's office, which informed him that his schedule for the next semester was changed, that he would teach his old graduate seminar on the Latin tradition and Renaissance literature, a senior and graduate course in Middle English language and literature, a sophomore literature survey, and one section of freshman composition. It was a triumph in a way, but one of which he always remained amusedly contemptuous, as if it were a victory won by boredom and indifference. Chapter 15. And that was one of the legends that began to attach to his name, legends that grew more detailed and elaborate year by year, progressing like myth from personal fact to ritual truth. In his late 40s he looked years older. His hair, thick and unruly as it had been in his youth, was almost entirely white. His face was deeply lined, and his eyes were sunken in their sockets, and the deafness that had come upon him the summer after the end of his affair with Catherine Driscoll had worsened slightly year by year, so that when he listened to someone, his head cocked to one side and his eyes intent, he appeared to be remotely contemplating a puzzling species that he could not quite identify. That deafness was of a curious nature, though he sometimes had difficulty understanding one who spoke directly to him. He was often able to hear with perfect clarity a murmured conversation held across a noisy room. It was by this trick of deafness that he gradually began to know that he was considered, in the phrase current in his own youth, a campus character. Thus he overheard again and again the embellished tale of his teaching Middle English to a group of new freshmen, and of the capitulation of Hollis Lomax. "And when the freshman class of 37 took their junior English exams, you know what class had the highest score?" a reluctant young instructor of freshman English asked. "Sure,
Old Stoner's Middle English Bunch, and we keep on using exercises and handbooks." Stoner had to admit that he had become, in the regard of the young instructors and the older students, who seemed to come and go before he could firmly attach names to their faces, an almost mythic figure, however shifting and various the function of that figure was. Sometimes he was villain. In one version that attempted to explain the long feud between himself and Lomax, he had seduced and then cast aside a young graduate student for whom Lomax had had a pure and honorable passion. Sometimes he was the fool. In another version of the same feud, he refused to speak to Lomax because once Lomax had been unwilling to write a letter of recommendation for one of Stoner's graduate students. And sometimes he was hero. In a final and not often accepted version, he was hated by Lomax and frozen in his rank because he had once caught Lomax giving to a favored student a copy of a final examination in one of Stoner's courses. The legend was defined, however, by his manner in class. Over the years it had grown more and more absent, and yet more and more intense. He began his lectures and discussions fumblingly and awkwardly, yet very quickly became so immersed in his subject that he seemed unaware of anything or anyone around him. Once, a meeting of several members of the Board of Trustees and the President of the University was scheduled in the conference room where Stoner held his seminar in the Latin tradition. He had been informed of the meeting, but had forgotten about it, and held his seminar at the usual time and place. Halfway through the period, a timid knock sounded at the door. Stoner, engrossed in translating extemporaneously a pertinent Latin passage, did not notice. After a few moments, the door opened, and a small, plump, middle-aged man with rimless glasses tiptoed in and lightly tapped Stoner on the shoulder. Without looking up, Stoner waved him away. The man retreated. There was a whispered conference with several others outside the open door. Stoner continued the translation. Then four men, led by the president of the university, a tall, heavy man with an imposing chest and florid face, strode in and halted like a squad beside Stoner's desk. The president frowned and cleared his throat loudly. Without a break or a pause in his extemporaneous translation, Stoner looked up and spoke the next line of the poem mildly to the president and his entourage. "Begone, begone, you bloody whoreson Gauls!" And still without a break, returned his eyes to his book and continued to speak, while the group gasped and stumbled backward, turned and fled from the room. Fed by such events, the legend grew until there were anecdotes to give substance to nearly all of Stoner's more typical activities, and grew until it reached his life outside the university. It finally included even Edith, who was seen with him so rarely at university functions that she was a faintly mysterious figure, who flitted across the collective imagination like a ghost. She drank secretly out of some obscure and distant sorrow. She was dying slowly of a rare and always fatal disease. She was a brilliantly talented artist who had given up her career to devote herself to Stoner. At public functions, her smile flashed out of her narrow face so quickly and nervously, her eyes glinted so brightly, and she spoke so shrilly and disconnectedly that everyone was sure that her appearance masked a reality, that a self hid behind the facade that no one could believe. After his illness, and out of an indifference that became a way of living, William Stoner began to spend more and more of his time in the house that he and Edith had bought many years ago. At first, Edith was so disconcerted by his presence that she was silent, as if puzzled about something. Then, when she was convinced that his presence, afternoon after afternoon, night after night, weekend after weekend, was to be a permanent condition, she waged an old battle with new intensity. Upon the most trivial provocation, she wept forlornly and wandered through the rooms.
Stoner looked at her impassively and murmured a few absent words of sympathy. She locked herself in her room and did not emerge for hours at a time. Stoner prepared the meals that she would otherwise have prepared, and didn't seem to have noticed her absence when she finally emerged from her room, pale and hollow of cheek and eye. She derided him upon the slightest occasion, and he hardly seemed to hear her. She screamed imprecations upon him, and he listened with polite interest. When he was immersed in a book, she chose that moment to go into the living room and pound with frenzy upon the piano that she seldom otherwise played. And when he spoke quietly to his daughter, Edith would burst into anger at either or both of them. And Stoner looked upon it all, the rage, the woe, the screams, and the hateful silences, as if it were happening to two other people, in whom, by an effort of the will, he could summon only the most perfunctory interest. And at last, wearily, almost gratefully, Edith accepted her defeat. The rages decreased in intensity until they became as perfunctory as Stoner's interest in them, and the long silences became withdrawals into a privacy at which Stoner no longer wondered, rather than offenses upon an indifferent position. In her 40th year, Edith Stoner was as thin as she had been as a girl, but with a hardness, a brittleness that came from an unbending carriage, that made every movement seem reluctant and grudging. The bones of her face had sharpened, and the thin pale skin was stretched upon them as upon a framework, so that the lines upon the skin were taut and sharp. She was very pale, and she used a great deal of powder and paint, in such a way that it appeared she daily composed her own features upon a blank mask. Beneath the dry, hard skin, her hands seemed all bone, and they moved ceaselessly, twisting and plucking and clenching, even in her quietest moments. Always withdrawn, she grew in these middle years increasingly remote and absent. After the brief period of her last assault upon Stoner, which flared with a final desperate intensity, she wandered like a ghost into the privacy of herself, a place from which she never fully emerged. She began to speak to herself, with the kind of soft reasonableness that one uses with a child. She did so openly and without self-consciousness, as if it were the most natural thing she could do. Of the scattered artistic endeavors with which she had occupied herself intermittently during her marriage, she finally settled upon sculpture as the most satisfying. She modeled clay mostly, though she occasionally worked with the softer stones. Busts and figures and compositions of all sorts were scattered about the house. She was very modern. The busts she modeled were minimally featured spheres. The figures were blobs of clay with elongated appendages, and the compositions were random geometric gatherings of cubes and spheres and rods. Sometimes, passing her studio, the room that had once been his study, Stoner would pause and listen to her work. She gave herself directions as if to a child. "Now, you must put that here. Not too much. Here, right beside the little gouge. Oh, look, it's falling off. It wasn't wet enough, was it? Well, we can fix that, can't we? Just a little more water, and there. You see?" She got in the habit of talking to her husband and daughter in the third person, as if they were someone other than those to whom she spoke. She would say to Stoner, "Willie had better finish his coffee. It's almost 9 o'clock, and he wouldn't want to be late to class." Or she would say to her daughter, "Grace really isn't practicing her piano enough. An hour a day, at least. It ought to be 2. What's going to happen to that talent? A shame, a shame." What this withdrawal meant to Grace, Stoner did not know, for in her own way she had become as remote and withdrawn as her mother. She had got the habit of silence, and though she reserved a shy, soft smile for her father, she would not talk to him. During the summer of his illness, she had, when she could do so unobserved, slipped into his little room and sat beside him and looked with him out the window, apparently content only to be with him. But even then she had been silent, and had become restless when he attempted to draw her out of herself. That summer of his illness, she was 12 years old, a tall, thin girl with a delicate face and hair that was more blonde than red. In the fall, during Edith's last violent assault upon her husband, her marriage, herself, and what she thought she had become, Grace had become almost motionless, as if she felt that any movement might throw her into an abyss from which she would not be able to clamber. In an aftermath of the violence, Edith decided, with the kind of sure recklessness of which she was capable, that Grace was quiet because she was unhappy, and that she was unhappy because she was not popular with her schoolmates. She transferred the fading violence of her assault upon Stoner to an assault upon what she called Grace's social life. Once again she took an interest. She dressed her daughter brightly and fashionably, in clothes whose frilliness intensified her thinness. She had parties and played the piano, and insisted brightly that everyone dance. She nagged at Grace to smile at everyone, to talk, to make jokes, to laugh. This assault lasted for less than a month. Then Edith dropped her campaign and began the long, slow journey to where she obscurely was going. But the effects of the assault upon Grace were out of proportion to its duration. After the assault, she spent nearly all her free time alone in her room, listening to the small radio her father had given her on her 12th birthday. She lay motionless on her unmade bed, or sat motionless at her desk, and listened to the sounds that blared thinly from the scrollwork of the squat, ugly instrument on her bedside table, as if the voices, music, and laughter she heard were all that remained of her identity, and as if even that were fading distantly into silence beyond her recall. And she grew fat. Between that winter and her 13th birthday, she gained nearly 50 pounds. Her face grew puffy and dry like rising dough, and her limbs became soft and slow and clumsy. She ate little more than she had eaten before, though she became very fond of sweets, and kept a box of candy always in her room. It was as if something inside her had gone loose and soft and hopeless, as if at last a shapelessness within her had struggled and burst loose, and now persuaded her flesh to specify that dark and secret existence. Stoner looked upon the transformation with a sadness that belied the indifferent face he presented to the world. He did not allow himself the easy luxury of guilt. Given his own nature and the circumstance of his life with Edith, there was nothing that he could have done. And that knowledge intensified his sadness as no guilt could have, and made his love for his daughter more searching and more deep. She was, he knew, and had known very early, he supposed, one of those rare and always lovely humans whose moral nature was so delicate that it must be nourished and cared for that it might be fulfilled. Alien to the world, it had to live where it could not be at home. Avid for tenderness and quiet, it had to feed upon indifference and callousness and noise. It was a nature that, even in the strange and inimical place where it had to live, had not the savagery to fight off the brutal forces that opposed it, and could only withdraw to a quietness where it was forlorn and small and gently still. When she was 17 years old, during the first part of her senior year in high school, another transformation came upon her. It was as if her nature had found its hiding place, and she was able at last to present an appearance to the world. As rapidly as she had gained it, she lost the weight she had put on 3 years before, and to those who had known her, she seemed one whose transformation partook of magic, as if she had emerged from a chrysalis into an air for which she had been designed. She was almost beautiful. Her body, which had been very thin and then suddenly very fat, was delicately limbed and soft, and it walked with a light grace. It was a passive beauty that she had, almost a placid one. Her face was nearly without expression, like a mask. Her light blue eyes looked directly at one, without curiosity, and without any apprehension that one might see beyond them. Her voice was very soft, a little flat, and she spoke rarely. Quite suddenly she became, in Edith's word, popular. The telephone rang frequently for her, and she sat in the living room, nodding now and then, responding softly and briefly to the voice. Cars drove up in the dusky afternoons and carried her away, anonymous in the shouting and laughter. Sometimes Stoner stood at the front window and watched the automobiles screech away in clouds of dust, and he felt a small concern and a little awe. He had never owned a car, and had never learned to drive one. And Edith was pleased. "You see," she said in absent triumph, as if more than 3 years had not passed since her frenzied attack upon the problem of Grace's popularity. "You see, I was right. All she needed was a little push, and Willie didn't approve. Oh, I could tell. Willie never approves." For a number of years, Stoner had every month put aside a few dollars so that Grace could, when the time came, go away from Columbia to a college, perhaps an eastern one, some distance away. Edith had known of these plans, and she had seemed to approve, but when the time came she would not hear of it.
"Oh, no," she said. "I couldn't bear it. My baby! And she has done so well here this last year, so popular and so happy. She would have to adjust, and baby, Gracie baby," she turned to her daughter. "Gracie doesn't really want to go away from her mommy, does she? Leave her all alone?"
Grace looked at her mother silently for a moment. She turned very briefly to her father and shook her head. She said to her mother, "If you want me to stay, of course I will." "Grace," Stoner said, "listen to me. If you want to go, please, if you really want to go." She would not look at him again. "It doesn't matter," she said. Before Stoner could say anything else, Edith began talking about how they could spend the money her father had saved on a new wardrobe, a really nice one, perhaps even a little car, so that she and her friends could... And Grace smiled her slow, small smile, and nodded, and every now and then said a word, as if it were expected of her. It was settled, and Stoner never knew what Grace felt, whether she stayed because she wanted to, or because her mother wanted her to, or out of a vast indifference to her own fate. She would enter the University of Missouri as a freshman that fall, go there for at least 2 years, after which, if she wanted, she would be allowed to go away, out of the state, to finish her college work. Stoner told himself that it was better this way, better for Grace to endure the prison she hardly knew she was in for 2 more years, than to be torn again upon the rack of Edith's helpless will. So nothing changed. Grace got her wardrobe, refused her mother's offer of a little car, and entered the University of Missouri as a freshman student. The telephone continued to ring, the same faces, or ones much like them, continued to appear, laughing and shouting at the front door, and the same automobiles roared away in the dusk. Grace was away from home even more frequently than she had been in high school, and Edith was pleased at what she thought to be her daughter's growing popularity.
"She's like her mother," she said. "Before she was married, she was very popular. All the boys... Papa used to get so mad at them, but he was secretly very proud, I could tell."
"Yes, Edith," Stoner said gently, and he felt his heart contract. It was a difficult semester for Stoner. It had come his turn to administer the university-wide junior English examination, and he was at the same time engaged in directing 2 particularly difficult doctoral dissertations, both of which required a great deal of extra reading on his part. So he was away from home more frequently than had been his habit for the last few years. One evening, near the end of November, he came home even later than usual. The lights were off in the living room, and the house was quiet. He supposed that Grace and Edith were in bed. He took some papers he had brought with him to his little back room, intending to read a few of them after he got into bed. He went into the kitchen to get a sandwich and a glass of milk, He had sliced the bread and opened the refrigerator door, when suddenly he heard, sharp and clean as a knife, a prolonged scream from somewhere downstairs. He ran into the living room. The scream came again, now short and somehow angry in its intensity, from Edith's studio. Swiftly he went across the room and opened the door. Edith was sitting sprawled on the floor as if she had fallen there. Her eyes were wild and her mouth was open, ready to emit another scream. Grace sat across the room from her, on an upholstered chair, her knees crossed, and looked almost calmly at her mother. A single desk lamp on Edith's work table was burning, so that the room was filled with harsh brightness and deep shadows. "What is it?" Stoner asked. "What's happened?" Edith's head swung around to face him as if it were on a loose pivot. Her eyes were vacant. She said with a curious petulance,
"Oh, Willie! Oh, Willie!"
She continued to look at him, her head shaking weakly. He turned to Grace, whose look of calm did not change. She said conversationally, "I'm pregnant, Father." And the scream came again, piercing and inexpressibly angry. They both turned to Edith, who looked back and forth from one to the other, the eyes absent and cool above the screaming mouth. Stoner went across the room, stooped behind her, and lifted her upright. She was loose in his arms, and he had to support her weight. "Edith," he said sharply, "be quiet." She stiffened and pulled away from him. On trembling legs, she stalked across the room and stood above Grace, who had not moved. "You," she spat.
"Oh, my God! Oh, Gracie! How could you? Oh, my God! Like your father! Your father's blood! Oh, yes! Filth! Filth!"
"Edith," Stoner spoke more sharply and strode over to her. He placed his hands firmly on her upper arms and turned her away from Grace. "Go to the bathroom and throw some cold water on your face. Then go up to your room and lie down."
"Oh, Willie," Edith said pleadingly. "My own little baby, my very own. How could this happen? How could she—"
"Go on," Stoner said. "I'll call you after a while." She tottered out of the room. Stoner looked after her without moving until he heard the tap water start in the bathroom. Then he turned to Grace, who remained looking up at him from the easy chair. He smiled at her briefly, walked across to Edith's work table, got a straight chair, brought it back, and placed it in front of Grace's chair, so that he could talk to her without looking down upon her upturned face. "Now," he said, "why don't you tell me about it?" She gave him her small, soft smile. "There isn't much to tell," she said. "I'm pregnant." "Are you sure?" She nodded. "I've been to a doctor. I just got the report this afternoon." "Well," he said, and awkwardly touched her hand, "you aren't to worry. Everything will be all right." "Yes," she said. He asked gently, "Do you want to tell me who the father is?" "A student," she said, "at the university." "Had you rather not tell me?" "Oh, no," she said. "It doesn't make any difference. His name is Fry, Ed Fry. He's a sophomore. I believe he was in your freshman comp class last year."
"I don't remember him," Stoner said. "I don't remember him at all."
"I'm sorry, Father," Grace said. "It was stupid. He was a little drunk, and we didn't take precautions." Stoner looked away from her at the floor. "I'm sorry, Father. I've shocked you, haven't I?"
"No," Stoner said. "Surprised me, perhaps. We really haven't known each other very well these last few years, have we?"
She looked away and said uncomfortably, "Well, I suppose not."
"Do you love this boy, Grace?"
"Oh, no," she said. "I really don't know him very well."
He nodded. "What do you want to do?"
"I don't know," she said. "It really doesn't matter. I don't want to be a bother."
They sat without speaking for a long time. Finally, Stoner said, "Well, you aren't to worry. It'll be all right. Whatever you decide, whatever you want to do, it will be all right."
"Yes," Grace said. She rose from the chair,
Then she looked down at her father and said, "You and I, we can talk now."
"Yes," Stoner said. "We can talk."
She went out of the studio, and Stoner waited until he heard her bedroom door close upstairs. Then, before he went to his own room, he went softly upstairs and opened the door to Edith's bedroom. Edith was fast asleep, sprawled fully clothed on her bed, the bedside light harsh upon her face. Stoner turned the light out and went downstairs. The next morning at breakfast, Edith was almost cheerful. She gave no sign of her hysteria of the night before, and she spoke as if the future were a hypothetical problem to be solved. After she learned the name of the boy, she said brightly, "Well, now, do you think we ought to get in touch with the parents, or should we talk to the boy first? Let's see, this is the last week in November. Let's say 2 weeks. We can make all the arrangements by then. Maybe even a small church wedding. Gracie, what is your friend, what's his name?"
"Edith," Stoner said. "Wait. You're taking too much for granted. Perhaps Grace and this young man don't want to get married. We need to talk it out with Grace."
"What's there to talk about? Of course they'll want to get married. After all, they... Gracie, tell your father. Explain to him."
Grace said to him, "It doesn't matter, Father. It doesn't matter at all." And it didn't matter, Stoner realized. Grace's eyes were fixed beyond him, into a distance she could not see, and which she contemplated without curiosity. He remained silent and let his wife and daughter make their plans. It was decided that Grace's young man, as Edith called him, as if his name were somehow forbidden, would be invited to the house and that he and Edith would talk. She arranged the afternoon as if it were a scene in a drama, with exits and entrances and even a line or two of dialogue. Stoner was to excuse himself. Grace was to remain for a few moments more and then excuse herself, leaving Edith and the young man alone to talk. In half an hour Stoner was to return, then Grace was to return, by which time all arrangements were to be completed. And it all worked out exactly as Edith planned. Later Stoner wondered with amusement what young Edward Fry thought when he knocked timidly on the door and was admitted to a room that seemed filled with mortal enemies. He was a tall, rather heavy young man, with blurred and faintly sullen features. He was caught in a numbing embarrassment and fear, and he would look at no one. When Stoner left the room, he saw the young man sitting slumped in a chair, his forearms on his knees, staring at the floor. When, half an hour later, he came back into the room, the young man was in the same position, as if he had not moved before the barrage of Edith's bird-like cheerfulness. But everything was settled. In a high, artificial, but genuinely cheerful voice, Edith informed him that Grace's young man came from a very good St. Louis family. His father was a broker, and had probably at one time had dealings with her own father, or at least her father's bank, that the young people had decided on a wedding as soon as possible, very informal, that both were dropping out of school at least for a year or two, that they would live in St. Louis, a change of scenery, a new start, that though they wouldn't be able to finish the semester, they would go to school until the semester break, and they would be married on the afternoon of that day, which was a Friday. And wasn't it all sweet, really, no matter what? The wedding took place in the cluttered study of a justice of the peace. Only William and Edith witnessed the ceremony. The justice's wife, a rumpled gray woman with a permanent frown, worked in the kitchen while the ceremony was performed, and came out when it was over only to sign the papers as a witness. It was a cold, bleak afternoon. The date was December 12, 1941. 5 days before the marriage took place, the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor, and William Stoner watched the ceremony with a mixture of feeling that he had not had before. Like many others who went through that time, he was gripped by what he could think of only as a numbness, though he knew it was a feeling compounded of emotions so deep and intense that they could not be acknowledged, because they could not be lived with. It was the force of a public tragedy, he felt, a horror and a woe so all-pervasive that private tragedies and personal misfortunes were removed to another state of being, yet were intensified by the very vastness in which they took place, as the poignancy of a lone grave might be intensified by a great desert surrounding it. With a pity that was almost impersonal, he watched the sad little ritual of the marriage, and was oddly moved by the passive, indifferent beauty of his daughter's face, and by the sullen desperation on the face of the young man. After the ceremony, the two young people climbed joylessly into Fry's little roadster and left for St. Louis, where they still had to face another set of parents, and where they were to live. Stoner watched them drive away from the house, and he could think of his daughter only as a very small girl who had once sat beside him in a distant room and looked at him with solemn delight, as a lovely child who long ago had died. 2 months after the marriage, Edward Fry enlisted in the army. It was Grace's decision to remain in St. Louis until the birth of her child. Within 6 months, Fry was dead, upon the beach of a small Pacific island, one of a number of raw recruits that had been sent out in a desperate effort to halt the Japanese advance. In June of 1942, Grace's child was born. It was a boy, and she named it after the father it had never seen and would not love. Though Edith, when she went to St. Louis that June to help out, tried to persuade her daughter to return to Columbia, Grace would not do so. She had a small apartment, a small income from Fry's insurance, and her new parents-in-law, and she seemed happy. "Changed, somehow," Edith said distractedly to Stoner. "Not our little Gracie at all. She's been through a lot, and I guess she doesn't want to be reminded. She sent you her love."
Chapter 16. The years of the war blurred together, and Stoner went through them as he might have gone through a driving and nearly unendurable storm, his head down, his jaw locked, his mind fixed upon the next step and the next and the next. Yet for all his stoical endurance and his stolid movement through the days and weeks, he was an intensely divided man. One part of him recoiled in instinctive horror at the daily waste, the inundation of destruction and death that inexorably assaulted the mind and heart. Once again he saw the faculty depleted, he saw the classrooms emptied of their young men, he saw the haunted looks upon those who remained behind, and saw in those looks the slow death of the heart, the bitter attrition of feeling and care. Yet another part of him was drawn intensely toward that very Holocaust from which he recoiled. He found within himself a capacity for violence he did not know he had. He yearned for involvement. He wished for the taste of death, the bitter joy of destruction, the feel of blood. He felt both shame and pride, and over it all a bitter disappointment, in himself and in the time and circumstance that made him possible. Week by week, month by month, the names of the dead rolled out before him. Sometimes they were only names that he remembered as if from a distant past. Sometimes he could evoke a face to go with a name. Sometimes he could recall a voice, a word. Through it all he continued to teach and study, though he sometimes felt that he hunched his back futilely against the driving storm and cupped his hands uselessly around the dim flicker of his last poor match. Occasionally Grace returned to Columbia for a visit with her parents. The first time she brought her son, barely a year old, but his presence seemed obscurely to bother Edith, so thereafter she left him in St. Louis with his paternal grandparents when she visited. Stoner would have liked to see more of his grandson, but he did not mention that wish. He had come to realize that Grace's removal from Columbia, perhaps even her pregnancy, was in reality a flight from a prison, to which she now returned out of an ineradicable kindness and a gentle goodwill. Though Edith did not suspect it or would not admit it, Grace had, Stoner knew, begun to drink,
with a quiet seriousness. He first knew it during the summer of the year after the war had ended. Grace had come to visit them for a few days. She seemed particularly worn. Her eyes were shadowed, and her face was tense and pale. One evening after dinner, Edith went to bed early, and Grace and Stoner sat together in the kitchen, drinking coffee. Stoner tried to talk to her, but she was restless and distraught. They sat in silence for many minutes. Finally, Grace looked at him intently, shrugged her shoulders, and sighed abruptly. "Look," she said, "do you have any liquor in the house?" "No," he said. "I'm afraid not. There may be a bottle of sherry in the cupboard, but I've got most desperately to have a drink. Do you mind if I call the drugstore and have them send a bottle over?" "Of course not," Stoner said. "It's just that your mother and I don't usually." But she had got up and gone into the living room. She riffled through the pages of the phone book and dialed savagely. When she came back to the kitchen, she passed the table, went to the cupboard, and pulled out the half-full bottle of sherry. She got a glass from the drain board and filled it nearly to the brim with the light brown wine. Still standing, she drained the glass and wiped her lips, shuddering a little. "It's gone sour," she said, "and I hate sherry." She brought the bottle and the glass back to the table, sat down, and placed them precisely in front of her. She half-filled the glass and looked at her father with an odd little smile. "I drink a little more than I ought to," she said. "Poor father, you didn't know that, did you?" "No," he said. "Every week I tell myself next week I won't drink quite so much, but I always drink a little more. I don't know why."
"Are you unhappy?" Stoner asked.
"No," she said. "I believe I'm happy, or almost happy anyway. It isn't that, it's..."
She did not finish.
By the time she had drunk the last of the sherry, the delivery boy from the drugstore had come with her whiskey. She brought the bottle into the kitchen, opened it with a practiced gesture, and poured a stiff portion of it into the sherry glass. They sat up very late, until the first gray crept upon the windows. Grace drank steadily in small sips, and as the night wore on, the lines in her face eased, she grew calm and younger, and the two of them talked as they had not been able to talk for years. "I suppose," she said, "I suppose I got pregnant deliberately, though I didn't know it at the time. I suppose I didn't even know how badly I wanted, how badly I had to get away from here. I knew enough not to get pregnant unless I wanted to, Lord knows. All those boys in high school and..." She smiled crookedly at her father. "You and Mama, you didn't know, did you?"
"I suppose not," he said.
"Mama wanted me to be popular, and, well, I was popular all right. It didn't mean anything, not anything at all."
"I knew you were unhappy," Stoner said with difficulty, "but I never realized. I never knew."
"I suppose I didn't either," she said. "I couldn't have. Poor Ed. He's the one that got the rotten deal. I used him, you know. Oh, he was the father all right, but I used him. He was a nice boy and always so ashamed. He couldn't stand it. He joined up 6 months before he had to, just to get away from it. I killed him, I suppose. He was such a nice boy, and we couldn't even like each other very much."
They talked late into the night as if they were old friends, and Stoner came to realize that she was, as she had said, almost happy with her despair. She would live her days out quietly, drinking a little more year by year, numbing herself against the nothingness her life had become. He was glad she had that, at least. He was grateful that she could drink.
The years immediately following the end of the Second World War were the best years of his teaching, and they were in some ways the happiest years of his life. Veterans of that war descended upon the campus and transformed it, bringing to it a quality of life it had not had before, an intensity and turbulence that amounted to a transformation. He worked harder than he had ever worked. The students,
strange in their maturity, were intensely serious and contemptuous of triviality. Innocent of fashion or custom, they came to their studies as Stoner had dreamed that a student might, as if those studies were life itself, and not specific